You are listening to Welcome to the Other Side, the podcast for parents navigating the turbulent waters of divorce and getting their footing in a new land. I'm your host, Meg Gluckman, certified coach and divorced mom of two kiddos, and I'm ready to share strategies for how you can move on from your divorce, how to co-parent without drama, and how to thrive in your post-divorce life. You are not alone on this journey. There's so much we can share together. Let's jump in. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. I am thrilled today to bring you a conversation with a friend of mine, Mihaela Bela. She is a certified divorce lending professional who's going to talk to us all about mortgages. And I brought her on because I've had clients ask more questions about mortgages lately, and I know it's a complicated topic when we're going through a divorce. It's a complicated topic even if we're not going through a divorce. Anytime anyone's ever bought a home, I'm sure you've had the experience of all these things that we didn't even know we had to think about before buying a home. So I wanted Ella to come on and share her wisdom with us. Let me tell you a little bit about her. She is an attorney and, like I said, a certified divorce lending professional, which means that she has specialized training that goes beyond the normal scope of mortgage financing. She's been trained on certain aspects of family law, financial and tax planning, real estate matters, as they impact the normal process of mortgage financing. And I am very lucky to be within the collaborative divorce community with Ella, and it's a pleasure to have you on. Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much, Meg. I'm so honored to be here. And really, before we get started, there's something that I want to say. I saw one of your LinkedIn posts today, and it was really an aha moment for me, because what you said was, if a client goes to an attorney and asks, how long is this going to take? How long is the divorce process going to take? Or how much is it going to cost? The attorney is going to give an answer based on what it depends, or it can be this many months. If it's a collaborative divorce, it can be this many months. But if someone comes to you, your answer will be, well, why do you ask? What is it about that you need to know? What is it that you have to work out for yourself throughout this process? And it just made me pause and realize that, oh my goodness, the way that you are approaching this and the way that you are helping clients is, it's part of that, what we don't know that we don't know. I never even thought the contribution that you bring. I knew that you're really important, but I didn't realize that there's this whole emotional aspect to the divorce that's not really met by most professionals. But when you have someone like you in their corner who can meet those needs, I think it helps most people process what's happening in a much more healthy manner. It helps them make more emotionally intelligent decisions, healthier decisions, and it probably helps them get past this really traumatic time period a lot quicker. It was such an aha moment for me. I applaud you. And then the next thought I had was, oh my goodness, I've seen Meg at so many training sessions. I mean, we had an co-parenting coaching session. You've been at the Collaborative Professionals of Washington conference. You invest a lot of energy, time, and money into educating yourself and knowing all of these different aspects so that you can show up for these clients and make a difference. And I have so much respect for you. I'm in awe, and I am so honored to be here with you today. So thank you.
Oh, Ella, that is so kind of you. And I really appreciate the feedback that the post on LinkedIn landed for you. Sometimes we put things out there that we hope will be helpful for folks, but we never actually know how people take them. So I really appreciate that feedback. And I'll just throw it right back to you too, which is, you've seen me at those places because you've been at the same training and you are, you know, invested in understanding all these different aspects of the divorce process for your clients as well. And I think that when they are able to come to you and they think they're coming just to talk about mortgages, but you have such a holistic view of what they're going through and all the different pieces that they have to consider and all these different decisions that are, you know, on the table at the same time, I think it creates an environment where they are so well supported for whatever decision they're going to have to make. So,
Yeah, that's my
yes.
goal. That's my goal is to be really supportive through
Yeah.
this very difficult and confusing time,
Yeah.
especially when it comes to finances.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So good. So tell us a little bit about how you got into working on mortgages and why you like working on this part of divorce process.
Well, when I was little, when I thought about my future, I always wanted to be a mortgage broker. No, just kidding.
She tried to say that with a straight face, but she broke at the end.
As you know, I've been an attorney for a long time, and I was actually transitioning because I was burnt out on tax law. And my spouse, who at the time he had been in the mortgage space for quite a while, he asked me to come and help him open a new branch. This is back, I don't know, 2019. And as I'm helping him with the business aspects, here comes a client, and I call her Alice because, and obviously for confidentiality reasons, but Alice has stayed with me all these years. Alice was a single mom of two young kids, and it was really important for her to keep the family home because she wanted to give the kids a sense of normalcy. And she felt that by keeping the house, she can achieve that. And it was a pretty litigious divorce. She ended up having to liquidate her 401k to pay for the legal fees to continue this fight to get the family home. And she got the family home, and before she signed off on the settlement, she went to a mortgage professional and said, this is what I have to do. I have to refinance the house within my name and within 6 months, in my name within 6 months, and my income is $8,500 a month. Can I do it? And he said, no problem, easy. So then after the divorce, she went to him to start that process, and it turned out that he couldn't do it. So she was calling around getting second opinions. It turned out that her support income was structured in such a way that it was not considered qualifying income. And even though she was getting a very large amount of alimony and she had a part-time job and she had child support, she just could not qualify to refinance the home into her name, and she had to sell. And that conversation changed really the path of my life because it was heartbreaking. It was preventable. If only Alice had the advice of someone before she finalized a divorce, someone who could have looked at her alimony and said, hey, instead of getting $6,500 a month for 3 years, how about if you get slightly less, but you extend it for the 42 months we need to make this qualified income? It would have been totally fine. But no one took the time to go through that analysis with her. And she ended up having to sell. So from that moment on, it was a natural pull to find out more about this. And I discovered the Divorce Lending Association and then just decided to go in full steam ahead. And I've been a certified divorce lending professional for about, I don't know, 3, 4 years now. And this is what I do now full time. I help clients who are going through a divorce or separation navigate this difficult terrain by getting the information they need to make an informed decision.
And I'm going to rephrase the story that you told just in muggle language, as I like to say sometimes, right? The layperson language, which was she and someone else had done kind of a back of the envelope calculation. Would her income be enough to qualify for a mortgage? And the quick answer looked like a yes. But in reality, because of the specifics about how you have to qualify for a mortgage and the specifics around how they look at the length, the timeline of spousal support, she ended up not qualifying for it, which is something that none of us who are outside of the mortgage industry would ever know to even think about, right? And we would never know to think about it, especially during the conversation with our attorneys or our mediator, where we're deciding on a spousal support amount and length of time, right? We would never think that, oh, I need to keep in mind what is going to be required if I'm the one who's refinancing the family home. There's no way, and there's no reason we should know that stuff beforehand, right? I mean, there's just no reason we should. But it's just one piece, and this is why I so wanted to have you on. It's just one piece that talking to an expert like you before finalizing anything is like so important.
Exactly. Very well said.
So tell us a few more things that folks need to think about when they're in the middle of their divorce and they're having that initial conversation about who should keep the home.
Yeah. The first thing that I do when I meet with clients, I find out, what is your goal and where are they in the process? And then the conversation quickly goes into, well, what is your budget? Because there's a very distinct conversation between what I can qualify them for versus what is it that they comfortably could afford. Because it makes no sense to qualify them for something that, yes, it's within their financial matrix qualifications, but that would mean a total change in their lifestyle. It would mean that the kids may not be able to do certain activities. It could mean that their lifestyle would change if they're a single person without any kids, such as travel. The joke that I make about this is having to eat cat food for the next 5 years. We don't want him to have to eat cat food. So when I do my reports for them, there's actually a line that goes budget, and there's a line that goes qualifications, and they're very distinct. Because that's the number one consideration, I would say, when they're deciding to if they want to keep the family home. The other consideration is, are there going to be any major expenses coming up with this house? And although with appraisals or even opinions of value that are issued by real estate agents, they're called comparative market analysis or CMAs. They will tell you what this house might sell for at in the market right now, the fair market value. But what it doesn't tell you is, well, I think your roof is on its last leg, and I think it needs to be replaced within the next 12 months, and that's going to be $30,000. Or I see that your fence is about to blow over, and that's $12,000. So doing an inspection by someone who can go through and identify what repairs will be needed, when they'll be needed, and an estimated cost is a really huge benefit to the person that's considering keeping the home, because those discussions have to be taken into account when they're dividing the marital assets.
And folks are coming in with some assumptions about what the process might look like to, okay, we've decided he's going to keep the home. This is what the refinancing process looks like. What do they tend to come in with, what their assumptions of it look like? And then what's the reality of how taking one partner off the mortgage, what does that actually entail?
Yeah, again, great question. One conversation that I have repeatedly on a regular basis right now is that of mortgage assumptions. There is a misconception out there that you can just do a mortgage assumption and keep the mortgage as is, and that is rarely, rarely the case. Generally, the only way to remove a departing spouse from the mortgage is through what is called a qualified assumption. And most of the time, those assumptions are only available for a small fraction of the loans out there, the ones that are government-backed loans, such as VA loans for veterans, FHA loans, or USDA loans. They make up about of less than 20% of the loans. So the 80% of loans out there, folks generally have a conventional loan where a qualified assumption is really, really difficult to get. And what ends up happening is they can get what is called a simple assumption where the departing spouse stays on the mortgage. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. And there's ways to kind of navigate that to protect both spouses, protect their credit. There's a lot that can be done. What is difficult to navigate, however, is that in most of those cases, because the equity in the house needs to be accessed to pay off the departing spouse, that cannot be done. You can't do it with a loan assumption. And so, if people are considering liquidating their investment accounts, they're not able to compare apples to apples, because when you liquidate an investment account, you're giving up the opportunity cost. Not only is your asset not going to sit there and grow for you, but the return on investment is generally significantly higher. in a coming from a retirement account to what you're saving on a mortgage. In addition, there's fees, there's taxes. And when you are taking on a new mortgage, because you have a higher interest rate, and you're all, and this gets to be a little bit complicated, but stay with me. You're going to be paying taxes. And generally, folks are going, when they're going through a divorce, they're going to switch from marry finally jointly, which has a really high standard deduction, to either single or head of household, which gives them a much smaller standard deduction. And so you're going to be paying either taxes or interest. So if you are choosing to itemize deductions and you're keeping that, or even if you are doing the standard deduction, you're keeping that low interest, you're going to pay more in taxes. When you're liquidating retirement accounts, especially if you're, depending on the age, you're going to have prepayment penalties and you're going to have the taxes associated with that. Versus if you can tap the equity in your house and structure correctly, you can deduct those, the mortgage interest, and it makes a huge difference on the tax liability for that person per year.
What comes up for me as I'm listening to you describe this is so often folks, as they step into divorce, are thinking, okay, we're going to have to split all of our assets 50-50. That's what we do these days. We just split everything 50-50. And the reality is, it's much more complicated than that. If you have retirement accounts, if you have a home that you own, it's just not so easy to just calculate quick, back of the envelope what 50-50 really looks like, because you have to take into consideration the opportunity cost, the loss through taxes, the potential for something to grow in value. There's just a lot of different factors. And again, there's no reason necessarily why somebody who's never gone through a divorce and never had to divide up assets in this way or value assets in this way should know all of this stuff.
Exactly. It's exactly what you said, is looking at these assets in a way that's equalized, comparing apples to apples, comparing what is the actual net value versus if one asset is liquid versus not liquid, it's taxable or not taxable, if it can grow in value or if it doesn't. All those things should be taken into account.
Right. And just in case anybody's not familiar with the term liquid and non-liquid, right? The liquid would be something like money that you have in a savings account, right? You can get out that cash, you can touch it right now. You don't have to sell anything in order to be able to have that actual cash, versus the value, the equity that we have in our home, where we don't actually have it until we either refinance or we sell the home.
Exactly. Very
Yeah.
well put. Very well put.
Yeah. Let me circle you back to what you were saying about a simple assumption where the departing spouse stays on the mortgage. How does that actually work? And does it prevent that departing spouse from then being able to buy their own place?
That's a really good question. It's actually one of the bullet points I wanted to discuss on the misconceptions list. If the documentation, your divorce decree, generally, if you're not going to litigation, the document is going to be called a property settlement agreement. And there's very similar documents. If you're going to litigation, they're just called different things. But if in one of those documents it says that the staying spouse is going to be responsible not just for that mortgage, but the language has to be very specific and allocate the taxes and insurance, then the departing spouse, and it's done correctly, written out correctly, and the departing spouse works with a lender who's really familiar with divorce mortgage, they can entirely disregard that mortgage from their debt to income ratio. So it does not affect their ability to qualify for and purchase a new property, even if they remain obligated on the current mortgage, even if they continue to stay on the title of that property. One thing that I see folks have a lot of questions about, Meg, is the difference between being on a mortgage and being on the title of a property. And they're two different things. The title has to do with who legally owns the house, and the mortgage is who is legally obligated for that mortgage. One of the other concerns that a lot of my clients have when we discuss the possibility of that simple assumption, which, by the way, it's really only a short-term solution. It's not something that you want to do forever because you don't know what's going to happen and how likely you are to be willing to stay on your spouse's mortgage after they get remarried. So, considering that most professionals that I've spoken with, based on their experience, they don't recommend it as a long-term solution. But as a short-term solution, perhaps until rates maybe come down a little bit more, or who knows what needs to happen in each individual's life. One, the way to protect the departing spouse who's still obligated on the mortgage is to make sure you have the right language in the property settlement agreement to protect their interest in being able to secure new lending. But then the second question becomes, well, what happens if the staying spouse inadvertently makes one mortgage payment? What happens to the departing spouse's credit? And the truth is, it gets ruined. So there is something that you can do as if you're in that situation as a spouse wanting to negotiate keeping the mortgage as is for a certain period of time. And you can do that by setting up a specific system where, let's say, Meg, that you're the staying spouse and you negotiate with your departing spouse and say, I'm going to make the mortgage payment. And by the 10th of the month, you will get notification from me via email showing proof that I've made that mortgage in full. Because if you haven't made that, if that mortgage payment isn't made by the 30th, you still have time to cure it. It's only hitting your credit when it's 30 days late or more. So if you have an agreement that the payments be made by the 10th and you show proof, then that's sufficient because it still gives the other spouse 15 days to cure. Some clients get even more creative and they have a safety net account, perhaps managed by an investment professional. And that investment account will have somewhere between 6 months, 1 month to 6 months of mortgage payments in there. And so if you're not able to make the mortgage payment on time, then the investment professional is basically pinged and they make that payment from the account on your behalf.
You mentioned misconceptions, and I'm curious if there's other misconceptions that folks come to you with thinking, oh, this is how we're going to do it, and you have to correct them that actually, that's not how it works.
Yes. One of the big ones is that you cannot get a mortgage if you don't have a job. And that's not true, especially in instances of divorce, or that you need to be in the job for 2 years before you can use that income. Another big misconception is that you need to put 20% down to purchase a new home, and that's not true either. Those are some of the big ones that I see on a regular basis. The other misconception is that seeing folks just being shackled to their 3% interest rate. I cannot give up that interest rate because I cannot afford anything else. And they'll make financial decisions based on that misconception without looking at the full analysis.
Yeah, and I imagine that that is especially just given housing prices. I mean, Ella and I are both in Washington State. We're near Seattle, and housing prices are high and interest is high, and there's a lot of families that can't necessarily envision how are we going to go from one home to owning two homes without major changes in our income. What are some of the things that you talk to folks about when they come in and that's how they're feeling, that they just can't envision how they're going to be able to own two homes in the same community going forward?
Yeah, it's all about how the departing spouse's income is structured, or the staying spouse income is structured. And one really, really big part of this is support income for both the paying spouse and the departing spouse. And I'd love to spend a minute and kind of break that down for you a little bit. For the paying spouse, there is this ability to actually deduct the payments that they make from the income versus listing it as an expense on the debt to income ratio sheet, which makes a huge difference. And that's only done if the correct language is used in the divorce documents. So let me give you an example. This is an actual client, and I call him Carl. And Carl had an income of about $9,000, and the spousal support he was paying was $1,500. He was trying to qualify for a mortgage of about $3,500. So if someone looked at his situation in a traditional mortgage way, the income of 9,000, the mortgage of 3,500, and the spousal support of 1,500, his debt to income ratio would be 55%. And there's a limit of 50%, which that's really the highest. I mean, sometimes it's lower, but the highest would be 50%. So at that 55% debt to income ratio, it wouldn't have been possible. However, because he had the right language in the divorce decree, we're able to deduct that spousal payment from his income. So doing that brought his debt to income ratio to 46%. And all of a sudden, that was doable. So the wording matters both for the person paying, but also for the person receiving, because if it's correctly labeled, we can gross it up by 25% for the person who's receiving. And what that means, Meg, is when someone is receiving a certain type of income, like Social Security or alimony or child support, it's not taxable. Therefore, we get to impute that amount that is not being taxed to help them qualify for a higher amount with the support income they receive. We're still going to have the conversations about budgeting, but often it makes a really big difference. And that really is dependent on the correct language being put in the documents before the divorce is finalized. The other really, really big component of support income for the receiving spouse, especially for alimony, is what we call a 636 rule. That goes back to the example of Alice, where her alimony was not awarded for a long enough period to be able to use that income to help them qualify for conventional loans, which is 80% of the loans out there. We need to have alimony that's awarded for a minimum of 42 months, which is 3.5 years. Longer is better because that allows them the chance to maybe refinance. But for sure, if it's shorter than 3.5 years, we cannot use that income at all. So those are two really, really big things to keep in mind.
I just want to do another definition here, and you can help me with the definition, which is when you're talking about debt to equity ratio, this is one of those numbers that mortgage providers use because they want to make sure that your expenses, especially your mortgage, isn't such a huge part of your income that you won't be able to afford it long term, or you'll have trouble in other parts of your life long term, right? So that's when you're saying that we don't want to be over 55% of our total income in the debt to equity ratio. That's because that's a cutoff. Like a mortgage provider is saying it's not safe, it's not a good investment for us to offer this mortgage if your debt is taking such a larger percentage of your income.
Exactly. And to clarify, that limit is 50%. With some programs, it's
50%.
even lower. Sometimes it's 45%. It really depends on how big of a mortgage it is, but that's generally the max is going to be 50%. And yes, exactly. Speaks to the risk the lenders are willing to take. And this is the overall rule guideline that guides most investors at 50%.
Right. And just to clarify with you, that's not just your mortgage debt. In that debt percentage might be other debts that you have as well. Is that
Exactly.
correct?
Really anything that runs through your credit. So when a lender pulls your credit report and they look at open accounts, things like credit cards, car payments, student loans, anything that you're paying for on a monthly basis gets added into that debt to income ratio.
One other question I had for you was the value of coming to you during the divorce process or shortly after. If someone doesn't think now is the right time for them to buy a property, but they want to have a plan, talk to me about the advice that you can give or the kind of plan that you can help them develop in order to be able to see themselves buying a home in the future.
Great question. There's so much that goes into it, and it's my planning is really catered to their specific situation, their specific goals. And I spend a lot of my time educating them so they can avoid really costly pitfalls. And I want to give you an example of that. So they may be aware that if I'm receiving child support, if I'm receiving alimony, I need to have it for this long, this amount of time, XYZ, correct? But they may not realize that the way the payments are received makes a difference on whether or not those payments become qualified. Knowing that for most programs, we need to show 6 months proof of receipt that they've been receiving the support income, the child support, the alimony. And so they have a plan saying, well, I don't really want to buy right now. I think I want to buy in early 2025. So that's when I'll reach out to you. They reach out in 2025 and I say, okay, show me proof of receipt for the past 6 months of your alimony income. And what they show me is a bank account, a joint bank account where the paying spouse deposits the alimony payments and the receiving spouse transfer from that account to their separate account. Guess what? We can't use that. So they have to restart that 6 month repayment period because there's a very specific way that these payments have to be made and documented. They need to come from an account that is only owned by the paying spouse and transfer into account that's only owned by the receiving spouse. You cannot transfer it to yourself. You can't pay yourself support income. So none of it counts. If you don't have that education and that plan ahead of time, you find yourself restarting that clock. And you may not have enough continuing months of support to actually fulfill the obligations of the requirement for that mortgage. So having these little details fleshed out for you is really important. Knowing the timing of, well, if you're wanting to do an equity buyout, you have to complete it by this date. Or we need this specific debt to be paid down. Or often student loans that are co-signed by parents for their kids, that's a big thing to work out ahead of time so that when you're trying to do your refinance or your purchase a year, 2, 3 years later, it's not going to come back and affect you. So there's a lot of details that if you miss that time period, it's almost impossible to go back and undo it. So that planning is crucial to be done, preferably during the divorce process before everything's finalized. So we have the chance to go back and correct or put in some small change to the language that makes a huge difference.
And really, what we're talking about is starting with just like one conversation with you. It might be that that is all that is needed right now to just set these things in place and make sure that whoever you're working with, you know, your attorneys, your mediator, take these things into account. I guess this brings up a really good question, which I'm sure many folks are thinking about, is like, shouldn't my lawyer know all about all of this stuff? Shouldn't they bring this up to me?
A lot of lawyers are really financially savvy and they understand all of these concepts. However, things change at such a rapid pace within the lending industry. In addition, interest rates go up and down. To have a real grasp on this, it's really a full-time job. I am educating myself constantly. And there's too many balls in the air for an attorney to keep in mind the lending, and it's not something they want to do because it's also a liability issue. If they're not aware of a change in guideline, they give you advice, they can be liable for that advice. So even though they're really savvy and really aware, first of all, they don't want to take the risk. Second of all, they don't have the time because they charge on an hourly basis, and you don't want them to be covering this information for you. I don't charge. There is no cost to my services, so I can sit down with you and explain how payments should be made, map all this out for you, give you a report, walk through the report with you line by line, and you're not sitting there worried, how much is this costing me? How much is this costing me? You can actually pay attention and know that I'm showing up for you with integrity and wanting to be a resource for you throughout this process.
Yeah, so cool. Oh my gosh, we could talk forever and ever. There's so many details to this. Like you're saying, it's a moving chess game. There's all these different pieces that are constantly evolving, and having someone like you in their corner, I think, just can bring so much confidence and ease, knowing that you've got your eye on all these details.
Exactly. I kind of alluded to this, but let me clarify. There is no charge for working with a certified divorce lending professional. This is because we cannot treat any individual going through divorce different than a married individual. So that's part of the Equal Credit Opportunity Act or ECOA. The only request is that if there is a mortgage component that really makes sense, that you consider working with our mortgage company, but there's never an obligation to do so.
All right, so why don't you tell us a little bit about how people work with you?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Generally, clients are referred to me by their attorney or mediator or financial certified divorce financial analyst. And they reach out, we schedule an initial consultation. That initial consultation, that's about 45 minutes if I'm working with an individual, or about an hour if I'm working with a couple together. I start with their goals and also just their situation, where they are in the process, what's happening to them. And then I go through an intake process where I gather the data that I need to then create what is called my CDLP report. And then we schedule a follow-up session about, a few days later. This follow-up session is via Zoom where I share my screen and I go through this report with them page by page because there's so much information and so many figures that it's really, really helpful if I go through and explain what each number means and then explain how they compare. They can compare those apples to apples that we keep talking about in our conversation. So after the intake, I create a report that I share with them. And generally, this is done via Zoom where I can share my screen. And the reason for this is really twofold. One, I want to make sure that the information that I have is correct, but also I want to make sure that the information that I'm presenting answers the questions they need to have answered so they can make a really informed decision about how to move forward. What are their options? How do they compare apples to apples on paper? Because some assets may be looked at differently depending on their after-tax cost, et cetera, et cetera. Once we have this report kind of fleshed out, I then send it back to them and I share with their divorce professional to help with that negotiation process, to help with the settlement process. And I find it that generally the CDFAs, the Certified Divorce Financial Analyst, if there's one involved in the case, they do find the report really helpful as to mediators and attorneys.
Awesome. Tell folks where they can find out more about you, Ella, and how to contact you.
Yes, our company name is called True Lending Company. Our website is truelendingco.com.
I'll put all of Mihaela's contact information in the show notes. And just one more time, thank you so much for coming on and sharing all your knowledge, all your wisdom about mortgages. I think as folks are navigating this process, it's just good to know what kind of questions to ask, some of the things to look for, and who they can reach out to for a lot more information. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. It's been really fun.
Absolutely. All right, y'all, that's what we have for you this week, and we'll see you next time. Bye now. Hey friends, hope you enjoyed that episode. For extra support with divorce or co-parenting, swing by my website, meggluckman.com. There you can grab your free PDF of 5 questions to prep for any divorce or co-parenting meeting. And you can also check out my Fearless Co-parenting class for loads of practical tips. If you're craving more personalized guidance, explore one-on-one coaching. I'd love to support you to make your divorce or co-parenting journey smoother and a whole lot less stressful. Whether it's just one coaching session to help you prepare for a co-parenting meeting, or whether we work together through your entire divorce process, you deserve support as you navigate these important and challenging times. Check out my free resources and learn more about coaching at my website, megluckman.com. Thanks, y'all.